thank you so much for joining us today, Edgar. It's great to have you back on the podcast. And more importantly, it's great to have one of your films in our cinemas on the big screen.
Absolutely. It's very exciting. I feel very fortunate with everything that's been going on to have two movies out in cinemas this year. And it's important, I guess three, if you count the Scott Pilgrim re-release, but that was kind of a briefer thing. But it's very important for me to support cinemas. So I'm thrilled that the Sparks Brothers is getting a theatrical release.
I feel like with documentaries, often there's more of a question of whether or not they would get a cinema release. Obviously, we're at Picture House. You know, we love playing documentaries and supporting them, especially at Picture House Central. We've got Claire likes to keep a screen just for documentaries if the program allows it. But I think something like, you know, the Sparks Brothers needs to be seen on the big screen, if for nothing else, you know, hearing that wonderful music in surround sound.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is that, and Thursday might change this, but I have yet to see it with an audience. I mean, I've seen it on the big screen, actually, because we had I mixed the film and et cetera, in a stage. And I did watch it with the crew, but I haven't watched it with the general audience yet. I've been sadly, you know, with the various festivals so far this year have all been virtual. So I'm looking forward to seeing it with an audience.
Oh, I think it will be electric. I'm so excited for that screening and then future screenings, because I think whether or not, you know, it's the opening of a film festival like it is with Sundance London, or if, you know, it just happens to be a Tuesday night screening at your local cinema, this film is a celebration. And I was watching it, the first time I saw this was on a link at home, and I got caught up in it, and I was watching it solo. So I just imagine that being amplified, you know, watching it with a crowd.
Well, what's been really nice about the response so far, and you know, I'm excited about it coming out in the UK, because the UK were the first territory really to kind of break Sparks, in the sense of, I guess we can be smug and say that the Brits got Sparks first, which is true, in that their first two albums they released on Warners didn't do anything in the US, and the sort of the start of the tide turning. And in fact, you know, their reprieve from maybe being kind of yanked completely was that the British press started picking up on Sparks. And then their third album, Kimono My House, was like a real breakthrough. It happens sometimes with, like, in culture, and particularly with music, that the Brits kind of anoint an American band first. It's what happened with The Strokes and Blondie, and it happened with Sparks, where Sparks had their first kind of big hit in the UK.
It feels like it's a good way to test the water, I suppose. Oh, they're blowing up in England. They're huge in the UK. It's funny when you actually come from America and you sort of have to do that dance before you break through. But I guess you, even in the film, you sort of tackled a, you know, are you British thing, which I guess Sparks must get quite a lot just because they're quite eccentric.
Yeah, I mean, the irony is that Ron and Russell grew up in Los Angeles and, you know, we're young men getting into music in the middle of like the Summer of Love in Los Angeles, when the big bands at that time would have been The Doors and Love and all of the Laurel Canyon set. And yet Ron and Russell were more interested in the more idiosyncratic British acts like Syd Barrett era Pink Floyd and, you know, The Who at their quirkiest, and The Kinks, you know, they're kind of like most idiosyncratic. So it's funny to me that they kind of started aping Anglo bands, and you can sort of hear that on the first couple of albums, that because I wouldn't have thought before making the documentary, I wouldn't have been able to pinpoint what Spark sounded like at all. But when they pointed out some of their influences, it was like, okay, I can kind of see that. I can kind of see the sort of Pink Floyd, Who sort of connection. But then it sort of became something wholly its own. And then ironically, once they had a breakthrough couple of albums in the UK, when they went back to the States and played Los Angeles, their home city, it was like Sparks, the hip band from London. So I think they've always had that kind of, there's always been that question mark hanging over them, because they're almost like too European to be like American rock. And, you know, there's a question mark over them here. Like, I think people in the UK thought they were maybe from Germany or something. They didn't really know where they were from.
I love a band that has an air of mystery, and Sparks, you know, have that in bucket loads.
Oh, yeah.
Which I guess is why they lend themselves to something like this, you know, an exploration of their career. But they're so theatrical and they are cinematic as a band. You know, their shows, the footage we see of them playing is really spectacular.
Well, I think they both have a background in film in a way. Well, Ron studied graphics at UCLA and Russell studied film at UCLA. And I think at one point planned to be a film director, but there, so that aesthetic sense came over into their stagecraft. And then obviously they're really famous for their wild album covers, which all look like missing scenes from films that don't exist. And then also the videos and just the way they present themselves as they became, you know, a duo after a few albums, then it's always them sort of tweaking their own iconic image, which I find fascinating.
I love how an artist or a band, you know, sort of changes over the years. And I think, you know, from what we've seen in the film, it's interesting that there's always an angle for them. There's always something new for them to explore, you know, over their many, many albums. Is it 25 albums now?
Yeah. And they're, I know they're already, well, I mean, it depends whether you count the Annette soundtrack, because then I guess that's 26 and they have a 27th on the way. So even I'm not completely up to speed.
In the film, you get to you film the band. Is it playing at the Kentish Town Forum?
Yes.
You know, you're such a fan of Sparks, but then to have, you know, to make this film, you want to film them live and capture that performance. What was it like for you as a fan filming them live?
I've done some very briefly early in my career when I was doing TV. I'd done some TV studio work, but I didn't really enjoy it. So then doing like a live concert was something that I was, you know, I'm very aware of, it's a different skill. So, you know, I got a lot of people on board that had worked on live concerts and that was great. But it was actually a really fun night because the gig was so good. It was just a matter of capturing that, really. I mean, I didn't try and get too fancy. I kind of figured that maybe I need to build up to doing, you know, like a Stop Making Sense or like a Shine a Light, Scorsese, Rolling Stones doc. But I'm really happy with the concert and There are clips of it in the documentary, but actually on the upcoming Blu-ray, we will have the entire concert on that because it was a great like 90-minute, 22-song show and Sparks fans will love it. So as soon as the idea of putting extra stuff on the Blu-ray came up, I was like, well, we have this whole concert. So we finished it off as a feature in its own right. And actually, that's going to show at the BFI next week. I think maybe it might be its one and only showing. We don't know. But like they're going to show the concert as a double bill with the documentary.
That's incredible. Well, that's like the ultimate DVD and Blu-ray bonus feature as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sparks fans will absolutely love it. And if you were at that show as well, it's like a perfect memento.
That's incredible. So in addition to new footage, like filming the gig and the you know the incredible interviews you have in the film, there's so much great archive material for Sparks. And I did wonder how you go about sort of collating that and piecing it together. I mean, is it as simple as asking the band for their archives, or did you have to sort of go off in, you know, a bit of a treasure hunt to get all of this footage?
Well, yes to both, but before even that, The key is you have an amazing archive producer. And Kate Griffiths, who worked on the film with her team, is just, you know, a genius and, you know, a very experienced kind of archive researcher stroke. I guess she's a producer, archive producer. But she had done many, many music documentaries and she was recommended to me. And she was really excited about the prospect of doing Sparks. And she said that she'd had one of the biggest responses in terms of gathering material, because I guess like there's TV stations around the world who've been sitting on some of this stuff for years. And then there are some things where there are like these exotic sort of, what do you call like white whales of like bits of footage that you know are out there, but like sort of it's not clear where they are. Like there are a couple of like key BBC clips that were tough to track down and one or two that seem to be gone forever. But then aside from that, there's just like tons and tons and tons of amazing clips. And then beyond that, beyond what Kate managed to get together, which I would watch on these amazing like file share, it was like a file archive hub where I could come into the office and click on a thing and I'd search it by year. So I go 1974 and all of the clips would come up. But the other thing that happened was the band are really good at archiving themselves. So a lot of the things like contact sheets for album covers or Russell's student film or some footage they had themselves of Super 8 that they had, and cards and letters and all of that. They're really good at keeping all of that stuff. I guess they were waiting for this documentary to come along, so there was a reason to dig it all out of the attic. But then on top of that, we did put the word out on social media, both through my account and Spark's account, to say, we're making this documentary. Do you have any photos, videos, films, or memories of Sparks? And Kate said that the response she got to that was the biggest that she'd ever had working on any documentary. And beyond just like amazing photos and bits of film and video, I mean, there's some things like there was this TV show they'd done in Munich in 1974, where the son of the director happened to have the 16 mil in his attic of this TV, like an OB thing that they'd done in Munich. And then sometimes it'd be something like, we got an email from a woman called Julia Marcus, who when she was 14 years old was a stage invader at their 1975 gig at Fairfield Halls in Croydon. And we happened to have that footage. So we had her email where she told an amazing, funny, heartfelt anecdote about being a 14-year-old stage invader and clinging on to Ron Mayall for the whole of one song and regretting it deeply. And the email was so funny and brilliantly written. I asked my producer, George Henk, and I said, hey, we should just get her to say that on camera. I mean, if she's comfortable being on camera and she can tell us that story, then amazing. And she did. And it's one of my favorite bits in the documentary, because not only does she tell the story, but she's got photos of herself when she was 14. And there's the footage of her jumping on stage and grabbing onto Ron. So to be able to cross-reference all of that stuff with not just the band, but also we had an interview with Richard Coble, who was the roadie on that tour. In fact, it was his first roadie gig. And now he's kind of like the biggest tour manager on the planet, because he's like the Rolling Stones tour manager.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, like, I think, yeah, it's not just a case of going down memory lane. It's actually like reconnecting these people with bits of their past. It sounds like it must be quite to be at the center of that, it must be quite a life affirming, you know, joyous experience.
Yeah. And it was nice sometimes to actually reconnect Ron and Russell with people they hadn't seen in years, or sometimes had never met. Like, there's a great thing, Todd Rundgren, who's in the documentary, who produced their first album, had not seen Ron and Russell, or vice versa, for 46 years.
Wow.
So I got to reintroduce them on camera when we were doing his interview. We basically did like a This Is Your Life and brought in Ron and Russell. And that is on the Blu-ray as well, because it's like a whole 20-minute vignette of them meeting again for the first time in 46 years.
Oh, wow.
And then there were other times, like I did some interviews with Ron and Russell in London. And you sort of assume that all famous people know each other, but it's absolutely not the case. And I was interviewing Stephen Morris and Gillian Gilbert from New Order. And then after that, I was interviewing Ron and Russell. And then both bands did the same thing. Stephen and Gillian said to me, hey, is it okay if we stay a bit longer and meet Ron and Russell? And Ron and Russell said, hey, is it okay if we come in 20 minutes earlier and meet Stephen and Gillian? And so then in the canteen in an Islington studio, I got to introduce Sparks and New Order to each other for the first time, which is wild.
Wow, that stuff must never get old, you know, like being able to make those meetings happen.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I also introduced them to Beck, who neither of them had met, which was sort of amazing because they're both like LA rock royalty as far as I'm concerned. So these things are always really nice. Even on Saturday night, I haven't seen Ron and Russell. The last time I saw them was on the set of Annette in September 2019. And then the pandemic happened. And then, you know, we finished the film. And obviously me and Ron and Russell have done like a zillion Zoom interviews. But they, you know, they're here in town to promote the movie. And so we had dinner on Saturday night, sitting outside. It was the first time we'd seen each other since September 2019 in the flesh. And then completely by chance, Mike Myers happens to walk past the table and see us. And he's in the documentary, but he's never met Sparks. And also, I haven't seen him since I recorded his interview in early 2019. So I was sitting with Ron and Russell having dinner, And then like Mike Myers basically stood behind us for like a full minute until we looked around and they pointed at us like, oh, wow. And it's like, oh, and I finally said, Mike, this is Ron and Russell. Ron and Russell, this is Mike. So it was really sweet.
You're such a lucky charm for them.
They call a connector, that's what they call them, right?
I did want to mention the interviews in the film, as well as the fantastic archive and, you know, your original live footage. You found, are there 80 original interviews with fans of Sparks?
Well, I mean, there's 80 interviews in the film. That comprises Ron and Russell, people they've worked with, you know, celebrity fans or, you know, bands or, you know, actors or writers that love the band. And then just kind of Sparks fans from every walk of life from different countries. So yeah, I did 80 interviews in total. And I did them all myself as well, which I know isn't always the case with documentaries.
I thought they were filmed. I really liked the style of them. Like they're very, again, like even though it's a talking, you know, someone talking directly to the camera, you know, beautifully lit, got really nice black and white footage of them. You know, I think you've added a layer of, you know, a cinematic layer to those. And you've got some great stories. Did you finesse your interview technique as you were going through the film?
Well, two things to talk about the look briefly. Jake Polonsky, who's an amazing DP, shot the movie. And funny enough, the reason he came to be involved with the project is when I first met Sparks back in 2015. When I first met them, I posted on Facebook. I was still on Facebook at that time before Facebook had become unbearably toxic. I posted on Facebook and Jake Polonsky messaged me, and I've worked with Jake many times, but he goes, oh my God, I'm such a huge Sparks fan. That's amazing. So I kind of kept that in my head. And then when it came to doing the documentary, he was the first person I asked him, hey, do you want to shoot the Sparks documentary? But the reason we shot it in black and white was because two things. It was a way of contrasting with the archive, because the archive goes from the 60s right until now. And obviously there's a lot of color footage. We felt it'd be nice if the talking heads were more timeless, because the interviews are spanning like 50 years. And also one of the best Sparks album covers to my mind is the Richard Avedon photo on the cover of Big Beat. So I said to Jake, I said, why don't we do all of the interviews like it's Richard Avedon shooting it, which is, I know that's a high bar, but, and then in terms of the actual interviews, I guess, I don't know about my interview technique, because it's my first time really doing it outside of moderating Q&As, but I guess my only strategy was to just put people at their ease, in the sense of I was talking to them as a Sparks fan to a fellow Sparks fan. It's not like I'm a Nick Broomfield style interrogator where I'm trying to get something out of them. I'm just sort of talking in hopefully quite a candid way. So I think if the interviews seem quite relaxed and candid or funny in that sense, it's because we're basically having a chat. So I think because of that, some nice things came out. It was a little more informal. And that goes for the interviews with Ron and Russell as well.
Yeah, it feels like you're, you know, as an audience member, you know, you're just walking in on two friends having a chat. There's some really good energy. How long typically did you do the talking head interviews for with the sort of the fans?
I guess the interviews went from, I mean, with Ron and Russell, I must have interviewed them for maybe like 9 hours overall, but we do like blocks of like maybe like 3 hours or something. But I think we did maybe like 4 sessions in total or something like that. And then I did a solo, I interviewed them together in a 2-shot. And then right at the end, I said, it was like Mr. and Mrs. I said, I want to interview you separately and do like 90 minutes with you. And 90 minutes with Ron, 90 minutes with Russell. And a lot of that footage is in the movie, because then separated from each other, a little even more kind of open about saying things without the other one there, which is really interesting. In terms of the other interviews, they could go for anything from like 3 hours to like an hour. Like I usually like do everybody for the minimum of an hour, you know?
Oh, wow. That's, yeah, I think it's it just sort of goes to show, you know, sort of how you whittle down, you keep whittling and whittling until you get, you know, something as tight as the Sparks Brothers.
I mean, you know, there are some interviewees that only pop up once really briefly. And in a way, part of the reason I wanted to do with that is to show over the years how many fans from different walks of life they've accumulated. So there might be people who appear in the documentary only really for one little paragraph, but in a way it's about the overall effect of seeing how many lives they've touched.
Absolutely. I think it just adds to the how special the band is and how special the film is for capturing this all. I think we need to wrap up there, Edgar, but thank you so much for talking to us today, and thank you for opening Sundance London with the Sparks Brothers, and we can't wait for that, and we can't wait to play the film on general release at the cinema.
No, I'm very excited and I'm looking forward to being there, Picture House Central, with a new movie.
Yeah, and I hope you do get to sit in the audience and watch it as well.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thank you, Edgar. I will hopefully see you later this week, but good luck with everything, and speak to you soon.
Speak soon. Bye.
Cool. Thanks, Edgar. Thanks, Premier. See you later.